Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all. My name is Jessica.
I'm Ed Hoffman.
Welcome to Moonsnacks, your podcast that brings together leaders, movies, and snacks.
Right now we're on the launch pad. You guys can't see this, but there's a massive rocket behind us. Now that we've got the funds for a moon mission, we now decided that our guests are going to get sent up one at a time with three films to take with them. Only three, not streaming Netflix situation. They get three laser discs.
Well, it's a weight issue. When you're going on travel, you have to minimize weight. You also have to things that can deal with radiation.
In addition to the three films, they're also going to get a snack.
Yeah.
Which is only one snack, but they get endless amounts of it and a book.
Really? I mean, what more would you want?
Maria has quite an introduction. I'm so excited for her as a guest. I think we're both fan readers of hers. Maria Tatar is an academic. Her expertise lie in children's literature, German literature, and folklore and fairy tales. Not only is she a prolific academic and author, but she has made the transition from being an academic to someone more in the popular culture. A lot of artists read her. You're from NASA, you read her. Yeah. She has these beautiful annotated books, Hans Christian Andersen and the Grimm's Brothers, and then also books that go more in depth to different aspects of folklore and fairy tale. Oh, Maria, it's so nice to see you.
Good to see you. Ed, hi, how are you?
I'm a little bit nervous. I'm sure Jessica told me that I have loved your work for decades. It had a major impact on NASA. I'll tell you this right now.
What?
I learned to get comfortable about the importance of story, because I may be wrong, but I always felt what I learned from you in the most recent work, the 1001 Heroines, is that every person has a story, and the story will be different, but you have to give people voices. Once I figured that out halfway through my term, we started using stories, and we had project people and scientists telling stories. And we value the fact that we see things and we tell things different ways.
We have a mission for you, people who love Still the World of Play and Pretend and movies. And Ed, what is that mission? We're going to send Maria to the moon.
Yeah. Now, this is a real honor to you. Hopefully you take that way. So one of my dreams a long time ago was that I would be the first psychologist supporting a colony of humans on Mars and the importance of values and ethics and creating something right. And one of the things I think is really important is that when you go to a new place, you have a storyteller. You have someone who can share stories of what works, lessons, getting people to talk about the kind of values we want. And so the purpose of sending you to the moon is to be just one of those people who can get us to think through myth, through our history, and through stories. What kind of society do we need to create together to hear all of our voices and to create a successful society? So hopefully you would like to go to the moon to be part of that colony. But that was our vote to have you as one of those early people on that colony.
You know, I have to say that, you know, I was always a sun worshiper, as many of us are. And it was only sort of in my 40s that I became moonstruck, that, you know, something, I'd like to think of it as becoming a lunatic. You know, Nathaniel Hawthorne writes in The Marble Faun about magic moonshine. And I had never understood that until one evening. And I don't wake up in the middle of the night very often, but woke up at 2 a.m. and I felt restless. And for some reason, I decided to go outside. I went into my backyard and it was lit up by the moon. In this way that was so extraordinary. I mean, I think I must have stayed there for close to an hour because I had never seen anything like it. And I think it's captured in Moonstruck to some extent. But I suddenly understood, too, why the moon figures so prominently in children's literature with Goodnight Moon, Papa, Go Get Me the Moon, In the Night Kitchen. So yes, I love the idea of landing on the moon. And I don't know whether you thought about whether I would be marooned there or would be able to come back. But I'm assuming I'm going to be there for a long time and need some powerful entertainment.
You certainly will. And three is, I know, a hard number to choose, but you will get three movies to take with you. So, Maria, what would be your first film be?
I think my first one is E.T.
It's too bumpy.
There's
the walk from here.
Watched it again, and you know, it holds up. It has not lost any of its fascination. And it is, we were talking earlier about connection, it is about making an emotional connection, learning how to feel. Elliot, and by the way, E.T., think of Elliot's name, begins with E, ends with, and they're sort of doubles of each other, and E.T. teaches him how to feel and to connect. He animates him, he reanimates him after a traumatic experience. He heals him quite literally at one point when Elliot cuts his finger on the saw blade. And this idea of healing and connection, I think, is dramatized so beautifully in the story. So, and of course, also emotional connection, but also flight, the fantasy of flying. And I love the way the film gives you the child's point of view for about the first half. You're seeing it, the camera work is amazing. You're looking at everything from below, the way that a child would see it. So you were infantilized and disempowered in a way. And then suddenly, you know, taking flight, being in control, being liberated and animated and all, and then the incredible finale of the film, which is so beautiful. You know, it's the Spielberg touch in great ways.
That's wonderful. I also love the idea that you are going to be a visitor on the moon. So in a sense, you've become an alien.
That's exactly it. And I think that, you know, there's something about suddenly being the other and discovering that you have to learn how to navigate this new world, how to survive in it. And the only way you're going to survive is by making friends with the others there. You know, the importance of friendship becomes quite vital.
Ed, do you remember seeing the film?
I guess I was just growing up in some ways when I saw it. It was transformational in a general way. You know, I love those kinds of movies. We've discussed this. You know, the notion of fantasy, the framing things from a child, you know, a troubled child, the connection to this, you know, the alien, you know, maybe up until that time, typically aliens were things to be afraid of. And the thing that was amazing about that was this was the alien was the good soul, and it was the people you had to worry about. And I remember watching that and seeing it in some ways, it had a pathos of the Bride of Frankenstein, where the monster, if you watch that closely, is, you know, this soul that is animated and has to deal with people trying to throw things. I always remember that scene where he's with the hermit, and they're establishing a friendship, and people bang in and they don't want it. And they start. So the thing with E.T. in a very cute way is that they turn the alien into a person of respect and appreciation and love. And you see how people have problems dealing with that. You know, the question I was going to ask when I thought about that for you, Maria, is in your work, in terms of the heroine and 1001 Faces, you talk about the importance of voice for all people. And you talked about your own experience in terms of going for your doctorate. And one of the things I've seen in organizations is women being silenced or dealing with other kinds of issues. And so I wonder if the E.T. is also that part of the alien. How does the alien be able to have their voice being heard so that people understand the reality and the truth? And I wonder, I'm asking you if any of that also appeals to you about that story of being the alien and trying to break through.
Yeah, that's a great question, because you're pointing to the vulnerability of E.T. and the way in which E.T. learns sort of about life on Earth, about language, and about emotion through, not just through Elliot, but through, he watches movies all the time. Remember when he's watching The Quiet Man? I looked this up. I hadn't realized what the film was. He was watching The Quiet Man with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara kissing. And at the same time, you get this wonderful montage with Elliot kissing the girl of his dreams. And so, you know, this sort of channeling of emotion. I'm reminded of a beautiful book by Ron Suskind called Life Animated, in which he tells the story of his autistic son, Owen, who learns about emotions and feelings through, guess what, by watching Disney movies. And he learns how to speak. I mean, think of E.T., the way that Elliot teaches E.T. language. So Owen learns how to speak. The first words he says are, "Juicer boss, juicer boss." And he keeps repeating that. And finally, his mother realizes that he's saying, "It's just your voice," from The Little Mermaid. And so yeah, E.T. takes up all of these, you know, fundamental questions about life and connection and friendship and vulnerability and learning, having somebody help you acquire a voice, because we don't do that on our own. We need other people to be our supporters. And, you know, I think with the Me Too movement, one of the things we forget is that many men were heroes and champions. And I think we don't celebrate them. And I think of my mentor in graduate school who, you know, was just, you know, I can think of the first time I met him as, you know, an undergraduate applying to Princeton. I was from the Middle West. I was really scared. And there he was, this distinguished scholar who gave me a long tour of the campus and was so encouraging. You know, so those voices have to be heard too, I think.
Can you paint me a bit of a picture about child Maria?
I was a very an introverted child. I was child of immigrants. I came to this country. My traumatic experience was going to kindergarten and howling. I think my poor sister could hear me howling from upstairs because there I was surrounded by, I mean, it was the E.T. Maybe, gosh, Jessica, what a great question, because I just realized I don't identify with Elliot. I identify with E.T., you know, alone in a sense, navigating this world in which I don't understand anything. It's a new place. And, you know, the place where I found refuge, where I found, I mean, through friendship, of course, too, but also in the library, reading and in books. And that was my way. You know, we call reading escapist, but it's an escape into adventures and all kinds of extraordinary things. And so yes, that was the place where I think I found ways to sort of compensate for being someone who felt very much an outsider, an alien, because we were the poor people in Highland Park, Illinois, which was a kind of very prosperous bedroom community, a suburban community. We were just fine. And we were not living in car. You know, if you think of the horrors many people are experiencing today, it was, and I always had the comfort of a very solid family. But reading the characters and books became my companions in many ways.
Absolutely. You know, and instead of escapism too, it sounds resourceful to find solace in stories because they allow you to reframe your own position and find your own voice and see yourself in a story or like a hero or like a character.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah. And I think not just see yourself in the story, because sometimes I think it's important not to see people who are like me, but to see people, to witness what other people have gone through and to form that bond with them in strange ways.
ZT is certainly about home, getting home, finding home. And it's interesting to me the way they finally get to the point where they appreciate ET and they love ET. And they're sad because he's going home, and he explains that it's about the home. And I wonder, I guess a question for you, Maria, is the core of myths and stories and folktales really about, in some ways, a search for a home, a safe place, a comfortable place?
Right. I mean, think of the Odyssey, the journey back home. And, you know, we think that fairy tales, of course, are all about the family, the hyper dysfunctional family, and, you know, the fractured family. And how do you not necessarily get back home, but create a new home? I'm always perplexed by the fact that scholarly literature, or scholars think of, academics think of fairy tales as domestic versions of myths, or as kind of the old wives' tales, the tales told by women about family life. And yet, you know, you look at myths, you know, the Greek gods, they're all also hyper-dysfunctional families. if you look at streaming today, at our entertainments, at our electronic entertainments today, at the core of so much of it, Sopranos to Stranger Things, all of these series that we binge watch are at heart. There may be another world out there. That other world often becomes an alternate, as in the Sopranos. You know, they become a family, a parallel family. So, you know, you've either got the structure of the parallel family or the alternate family, the one that sort of makes up for the horrors of the first family. So that's something that we're always, I think, always need to work through. And as much as I was saying before, you know, that, you know, my circumstances as an immigrant child were by, you know, comparison, fairly comfortable, even in a prosperous, you know, there's dysfunction in every family. As much as we love each other, there's always conflict and turmoil and rivalry. Yeah.
I think that's because none of us are fully aware or realized individuals, so we kind of all are bumping up against each other. I don't know one family that I can point to and say that's highly functional. I think highly dysfunctional seems to be a bit of the norm.
But I think that's what, you know, this idea of sort of teach us about expansive generosity too. You know, the move that makes you feel big and powerful and heroic is the right move.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, I'm into that. And so, Maria, what a rich vein ET is. I love this choice. It's yours. You get to bring it to the moon. Tell us, what is the second film?
Oh, my second choice is Shawshank Redemption. And gosh, you know, all of the, I'm with the heroes here. I realized, oh gosh, I don't have any heroines, but never mind, because Shawshank is such a brilliant film.
The next morning, right about the time Raquel was spilling her little secret, a man nobody ever laid eyes on before strolled into the Maine National Bank. Until that moment, he didn't exist. Except on paper.
May I help you?
I did rewatch parts of it, and I realized, you know, I'm looking at it now through a different lens. And in some ways, I see this film as having a powerful subtext about slavery. It's about prison, but prison is a sort of metaphor. But let's get back to, you know, what the film when it was made. And I think that there's a kind of that moment of cinematic rapture, where for the briefest of moments, every man in Shawshank was free. That's the voiceover from Morgan Freeman. And how does this happen? It's when Andy decides to well, speak truth to power, stand up to authority. And he plays this beautiful duet from The Marriage of Figaro. He broadcasts it into the prison yard. And there's a wonderful montage where you see how the music captures, the voices of these women captures the attention of the prisoners. And then, you know, they are all just standing there in this reverent moment. And it's followed by violence, by the crashing of the breaking of glass, the prison guard who is going to, you know, beat Andy up. So it is the briefest of moments, and yet it is a kind of liberation with the promise embedded in it of hope, something that Andy holds on to, that he clings to, and that Red is always dismissing as silly and frivolous. But Red is won over in the end. And those words, you know, I hope the Pacific is as blue as it is in my dreams. And I hope I get to shake the hand of my friend. You know, again, this idea of connection in the film. So it's a great work of art, and it shows us again, you know, the power of the movies to wake us up emotionally, to animate us. And, you know, is it transformative? Are we changed? Who knows? You know, the psychologists will analyze this and say, well, for 20 minutes we are. But it doesn't last. I think it does last. And I think it lasts in the kinds of conversations we're having and that we have with others about the power of art to help us navigate the worst of circumstances.
One of the things I think that you're talking about is the importance of hope. And I think it was interesting that at the beginning, Red is talking about hope as a dangerous thing, which to me seems to fit with, again, many stories and about the danger of it.
Yes, well, the famous double-edged sword and the skepticism about hope. But I think the fact that he's won over is quite extraordinary. Yeah.
And I do like the idea of being able to find freedom, connection, deep friendship, and liberation in a closed universe, which is what the jail is. And so if you're on the moon, if they can find it there, you're going to be able to find it anywhere. But there is a filmmaker's lesson in that film, too. And I didn't know this recently. I was listening to Dax Shepard's podcast, Armchair Expert, and they were talking about Shawshank Redemption. And I didn't know it was a flop when it came out.
That's interesting. I was not aware of that either. And yet it's become a classic. You ask about when I saw it. And I think part of the reason I block it out is that I play that clip with Andy in the warden's office, putting the needle on the record to my students. And when the clip ends, you can hear a pin drop in the lecture hall. And we all just have to take a breath and sort of try to process what we have just seen. Suddenly, you're listening to the voices of imprisoned men and hearing their stories too. So that's another aspect of it. And it was a flop financially, but it's now, has it recouped?
Oh, absolutely, and found its audience. And I'm always interested in story and time. So it found its time. Marie, you mentioned teaching, and I think both Ed and I would be remiss not to look a little bit about that part of your life, too, because you're not just an author, and you don't just lecture, and you don't just get sent to the moon. You teach. It's a huge part of your career. And you said, do you often use film in your teaching?
Yes. And as we speak, I realize that film helped me understand. So I spoke about how fairy tales became such a fascinating topic for me because they became a portal to not just the academic world, but, you know, the world, all of us, you know, all of us are connected with stories. And film, I think, became a portal to affect, to, you know, what psychologists call affect, emotional life. I began to understand how, you know, I would put on a film clip and I press the button and I watch the students lunge forward, you know, and then the clip ends, the sequence ends. And as I said, silence, but I can feel the emotional energy is just palpable. And so that bonding experience, you know, it really changed my way of teaching. And I think helped me to forge connections to my students that I had never had before. And I always had on an intellectual level. But suddenly, and I think academia has woken up to this, you know, thinking about, you know, what Bernstein called the effect of music, you know, the effect, you know, what does this do to us? Is it, you know, what does it trend? What does it change in our lives? What does it give us? And what does it help us to do? So my teaching went through many phases over the years. But I think, you know, what I also learned, Ed, was about how, you know, students are just the hunger for stories. And for, I mean, it's nourishment. It's soul food. It's everything that they want to get from the college experience in a way. Not every, I mean, they want to get the analysis, the, you know, skills and all of that, but those are nothing without the power of connection.
You know, I was going to say, I think, you know, I've mentioned in my background at NASA, sometimes people are surprised about the power of stories. I worked with one large organization on knowledge. How does it get captured and shared? And one of the activities I did was I asked, take a few minutes and think about a project that you worked on that had a lot of problems and challenges, but ended up successful, and just describe what happened. They took a few minutes and I started looking around the room. There was a couple of hundred in the room, mostly senior folks. And I saw one man starting to tear up. And when we started going around, he was nice. He volunteered. He said, you know, I've worked in this place for 36 years. And when you asked me to think about a story, I really started realizing how much I love this place and how important it is to this country and to the city and to the citizens. And how much I appreciate working with the talent, because that's how we overcome these problems. And he said it saddened him a little bit that we've never done this before. But I so value where I work, and I have love for the people I work with. And I'm glad that I had this opportunity. But in 36 years, we've never done something like this. And I heard that in different ways at NASA. I had a senior leader come up to me, said, thank you. And I said, thank you for what he says. You're allowing us to tell our stories, which you're allowing us to be the experts, the gurus, and to learn from each other. And usually when we learn, it's always been we bring somebody else to who has the knowledge and the wisdom when we listen. And the ability to tell a story means that we have something worthy to tell. And I've seen the emotions of giving people the chance to tell their stories and to listen to their stories. So.
And you're pointing also to gratitude. And I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but I think of my son-in-law who credits all of his personal and professional success to writing great thank you notes. His mother taught him to write thank you, and he developed this into an art form. And the secret is not just writing a wonderful thank you note, but doing it immediately. You know, and there's that, you know, again, you know, expansiveness, generosity, being, you know, and seeing the other, letting them know that you heard them as well. So I love that story, Ed. Thank you.
Do you know, Marie, you also are getting me thinking that maybe the reason why Ed and I both find films transformational and the reason why you did in your classes is you can read a story or be told a story and have the privacy of your imagination, even with a group. So, but all of you are hearing the same story and seeing a different one, but there's deep intimacy in witnessing a story, the exact same story together. I mean, that is truly intimate. So, you know, picturing you showing a clip in front of your class, that's quite profound, actually.
Oh, yes, and in the dark, I would add that to it. There is something about that, you know, that you're together. You're alone together in a way. You're with each other, and you know, I talked about that sort of palpable energy. You even in the dark, you feel the presence of the others in the room, and you get their emotional vibes as well.
There is a story, Ed, of when you hired Jay, who is an oral storyteller, and he had to come to NASA headquarters and kind of sit in an executive board meeting describing why we just hired an oral storyteller. And do you remember what happened when he actually, the room was not the most friendly until he started telling his story? Because, you know, some of these guys who were in suits were like, well, what's your deliverable? And he said, look, my deliverable's a story. And everyone was getting very uncomfortable with this. And so he stood up and said, you know what, let me tell you a story. And he proceeds to just tell a story. And looking, you know, Ed was sitting across from me, a bunch of other people were in the room, but looking at the faces of people who then melted into the story, these adults, and suddenly they got it. It was a very magical moment.
What you described, Jessica, was so familiar, this discomfort with the scene. Yeah. You're going to tell a story in front. Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, totally.
and unless you're a really good storyteller, it is weird. You know, it can fall flat. And it can, you know, it may not be relevant or relatable and all of those. So things can go wrong.
Maria, what is your last film that you'll bring with you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think, you know, getting to back to Aliens, feeling like an alien and an outsider. I've chosen Get Out.
Check. Do you have your deodorant?
Check.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's...
I ain't never seen you like this before, bro.
Meeting family and taking road trips. Don't come back all bougie, man.
Come back, get your damn pants up to your damn stomach.
And I have to do full disclosure because it was produced by my son-in-law, who specializes in horror, who managed to Jordan Peele, sorry. My son-in-law is Jason. Jordan Peele sort of reconfigured the tropes of horror. And he took a story that is dear to our hearts, Bluebeard, and reversed the gender roles. And Hollywood is so great at pushing the refresh button. And the reason I mentioned Jason actually is that Jordan Peele took the script to something like 20-odd studios, and everyone said no. And it was only thanks to an intern working at Blumhouse that the film got made. Well, it may have gotten made eventually anyway, but sooner rather than later. And I'm still so curious about whether, you know, this is a story about domestic violence way back when. Charles Perrault put it between the covers of a book. It's about a serial murderer. Bluebeard is about a serial murderer, domestic violence. And then suddenly we have a woman in the role of Bluebeard as the villain. And so, you know, it suddenly it's a film about race in America. And so, you know, talk about getting us to think more and think. I always think of Einstein. I'd love to, who knows whether this is true or not, but Einstein said, if you want intelligent children, read them fairy tales. If you want more intelligent children, read them more fairy tales. And I always think, I like to think of them as riddles wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. That's Churchill on Russia, but never mind. we have to unpack so much. And this is why, you know, you can see a film and I can go through this repetition compulsion on the moon watching these films over and over again, because each time they're a little different.
It's also the importance, I think, the story. Sometimes you just got to, like the title says, get out. I remember part of the movie has his friend who's saying, get out of that place and don't stay there. And yet I think sometimes we feel the safer things is to stay in a situation that's clearly not right. And, the lead in that gets to the point where this isn't right and I'm going to take action to go into a different place, which is a very powerful message, I think, in itself.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And actually, as you say that, I'm reminded of the importance of friendship, because that is without friendship, without your friend being there for you, things would have turned out quite differently.
Absolutely. There's also a tone to that film. It's almost joyous fear, because I saw it in a cinema in Edinburgh, in a really old cinema, these plush couches that you kind of just sink into. So while she's doing the tea moment, everyone could feel themselves kind of get sucked in.
But in
the sunken place. But people were screaming aloud and then laughing. There's that when I say joyous fear, it's fear first and surprise and horror, proper horror. But there's a bit of a release, a tension release that we've all didn't realize we were holding on to.
It's good old catharsis.
Good old catharsis.
And in a setting with others, that collective experience. And I mean, that's what's so great about movie theaters is the respond, you know. And it's funny how people will describe seeing a film and hating it. And I say, where did you see it? And it turns out on a small screen. And then the person next to me will have seen it in a movie theater and will say, it was great. You know, we were all laughing and, you know, so the movie changes depending on the setting.
Well, Maria, you are brave to watch it on the moon alone. I hope you're not alone forever, because we are sending friends your way. And you're also a good friend, you know, supporting Jason's work. It's a phenomenal film. So I like that there's a personal connection to the final film. The launch is about to happen.
I think one of the things that you get to choose is your favorite snack. And the good thing about the snack or the food is that it continuously replenishes itself. So anything you choose, it's always available.
And has no calories.
No calories.
Well, you're almost weightless on the moon anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. So Emek and Bolio's Oreo ice cream.
Oh, nice choice.
But I have to add a footnote. For breakfast, that's for dinner. For breakfast, I would like warm French croissant.
Oh, you know what? Both are yours. We're generous here. You get both.
That's excellent.
Do you have jam or anything on your croissant or just plain?
You've read my mind. I was going to add with lots of butter and some, any kind of jam would be fine.
Maybe a selection so you don't get sick of one flavor. That's probably best. Oh, well, that sounds delicious. They're yours. And you get a book, one book that you can bring with you.
Gosh, well, again, this was a great question because I have thought about this so often. And I finally landed with Middlemarch.
Oh, yes.
I chose it for many reasons, mainly because of the last sentence of the book, which everyone can look up. And because it's just soothing. And I finally found a heroine. I chose all these guy films.
Yes.
But we have Dorothea it's a novel that I discovered late. I read it in high school. I don't
know.
Did
you? I'm just
out of my mind. Yeah. I mean, it's so, you know, it's so irrelevant.
It's also dense. I remember reading it for the... you can read the same paragraph and over again, and it's almost like she's speaking in a fourth dimension. You just think, oh, God, there's a lot of here. There's a lot here.
That's right. That's right. And that's why I think I remembered so little of it, and I could reread it, and it was a voyage of discovery for me.
You will get so much pleasure out of having that on the moon with you. There's a lot to unpack, and in there, it will keep you occupied. Mm-hmm. Maria, it has been such a pleasure. I'm hesitant to send you to the moon because I think Ed and I want more time with you, but we will be joining you at some point up there.
That's right.
Oh, I can't wait to hear your choices.
I know we do have to work on them, Ed. You know, when you had a lot of good seconds too, from Winged Migration to Moonstruck. I know that you were so thoughtful about your choices, Maria. That's a good collection.
Go for launch.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Roger, go.
Bye, Maria. Good luck on the moon.
Crew one for all.
Bye-bye.
Tanks pressing for Strombeck recheck.
Great trip. We've packed you croissants.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Doing the countdown. All right.
Falcon 9 is configured for flight.
You might get to see ET in person.
I'm excited. 1-0.
Stage 1 propulsion is nominal. Power and telemetry nominal.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for joining us. There's no good story unless there are people to enjoy the story. We'll see you at our next podcast, and if you have ideas, let us know.
Moon Snacks is supported by Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light, with hosts Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman, and special guest Maria Tatar. It was produced, edited, and with original sound design by me, Ben Please.
Brought to you in partnership with Highlands and Islands Enterprise, the Economic and Community Development Agency for the North and West of Scotland, hie.co.uk.